Board Game Bros.
Hello, listeners.
Hi, everybody.
It's another episode of the Board Game Brothers podcast. I'm Jeffrey Craig.
And I'm Matthew Craig.
We are brothers in real life.
And game designers in real life.
And this is our podcast where we talk about board games, board game design, gaming, game design, all that fun stuff. And it's a regularly scheduled episode of our podcast. And today we are talking about one particular game. We're going to talk about its gameplay. We're going to talk about some strategies that you can implement in the game yourself as a player. And then we're going to talk about how the game was designed. So, Matthew, what game are we talking about today?
We are talking about Between Two Castles of Mad King Ludwig, designed by Matthew O'Malley and Ben Rossett, published by Stonemaier Games in 2018. And this is kind of interesting. It's a collaboration between Stonemaier Games and Bezier Games. It is a fusion of the games Between Two Cities by Stonemaier Games and Castles of Mad King Ludwig by Bezier Games.
Very interesting. A fusion game.
Yeah.
So just to give a brief explanation of what this game is about, in Castles of the Mad King Ludwig, players are architects hired to construct castles for the king, each player building one castle with the player sitting to their left and another castle with the player sitting on their right, starting with a throne room. In each round, players draw 9 room tiles, and from those 9 room tiles, they pick 2 to use in either castle, then pass the rest to the next player. This continues until there is only 1 room remaining, the leftovers are discarded, and then a second round is started. When you're picking rooms from a hand, players have to be silent. But when placing the rooms in your castles, you can discuss strategy with your neighbors. You can include in the strategy discussion details on what you are passing them. So during the first round, the players pass the rooms to the left. In the second round, players pass to the right. And after the second round ends, players score how many points their castles made. Each player keeps the lowest score of their 2 castles for themselves. And then whoever has the highest score amongst those wins. So that is the basic description of Castles of the Mad King Ludwig. Now we're going to get into the strategy. Well, I guess first we'll describe the game a little bit further, because there's a lot more to it than just drafting rooms and passing them.
Right.
Because there's a lot of different kinds of rooms you can add to your castle.
Yeah, a lot of different room types. So we should go ahead and explain those.
Sure. All right. Room types.
Yeah.
Where do we start?
Let's start from the top and go down. Now, I say top because there is a little handy player reminder card that lists all of the room types and how they work.
All right. So the first room listed in the game is called a food room. It is noted by its yellow border and details. A food room is worth 2 points for each room of a particular type that is either above or below it in specific positions, or to the left and right of it in specific positions.
Right.
Now, you lay out these rooms in a grid flat on the table, but you start with your throne room, and rooms can be placed on the same level of it as it or above it to make extra stories in your castle, or sometimes below it to make basement levels to your castle. Now, food rooms and the next few types of rooms can only be placed on the same level and above. We will tell you when we get to the rooms that can go below your castle into the basement.
Right.
Okay, so that's the food room. There is the living room, is the next type of room. It scores 1 point for each room of a particular type in the 8 spaces surrounding it. Next is the utility room. It scores 1 point per connected room of a particular type. So you sort of start at the utility room and you draw a line through other rooms, all of a particular type, until it ends.
Yeah, kind of like a big cluster of rooms.
Yeah. Or a big trail of rooms, path of rooms. But it doesn't have to be in a straight line.
Right.
You just have to be able to trace an unbroken line through all the rooms.
Yeah.
And you get 1 point for each room. Outdoor rooms give you 1 point per type of room in your castle anywhere. Outdoor rooms do not have to be connected to anything or next to anything to score points. They just look at your whole castle. Sleeping rooms are worth 1 point unless you have at least 1 room of every other type that we've mentioned, plus the next type of room. In that case, they're worth 4 points each if you have at least 1 of every other type of room, except the downstairs room, which we'll get to. Corridor rooms are worth 1 point per per every room with a particular wall hanging surrounding them. Now, each room we've mentioned so far has, they have their room type, which has a color associated with it. By the way, I guess I'll go back real quick. Food is yellow, living room is purple, utility is orange, outdoor is green, sleeping is blue, corridor is light gray. So every room will also have a wall hanging in
of,
it.
Of
so,
which there are four types.
Right. There are torches, there are mirrors, there are swords, and there are pictures or paintings, I guess. So corridors score 1 point for each wall hanging of a particular type in the rooms surrounding them. And then the final type of room is, well, I guess not technically the final, but the final type of basic rooms there are is the downstairs room, which scores 1 point for every type of room above or below it of a particular type.
Right.
By the way, corridor and downstairs, corridor rooms can be placed on the same level or above your throne room or below your throne room. They can go anywhere in your castle. Downstairs rooms can only be placed below your throne room.
Right. They are literally downstairs rooms.
Yes. And again, they score points for each room of a particular type above or below them.
Right. we should probably mention that your throne room itself has both a wall hanging and a way of scoring.
Mm-hmm.
Throne rooms care about two types of rooms in two specific places, and it can be either one of those types of rooms in either of those specific places.
So right, it's like so two it might point, want to yeah. have a food and a living room, a food and or a living room in the two spaces above it, because a throne room is as wide as two rooms. It's right. like two squares.
Two together. By one.
It's a long, it's a rectangle. Or it might want like a corridor and or a downstairs in the two spaces beneath it. Or it might want one particular room above it and one particular room to the left of it, so on and so forth.
Exactly.
So these are the pieces in the game, the types of rooms that you can add to your castle. Now, in addition to scoring points from their own effects, you get a bonus for collecting three of a kind and five of a kind of any room. So if you collect, and it's different for each type of room. If you collect three of a kind of a food room, then you get to immediately draw five more room tiles and then choose one to place into your castle. So it gives you an extra room from a selection of five. If you get three living rooms, then you get to place a throne room attendant in your throne room. This is a bonus thing that gives you extra points for each wall hanging of a particular type in your castle.
Right.
And there's four throne room attendants, one for each kind of wall hanging. You just get to pick one and put it in your castle.
Yeah, and you can only have at most two throne room attendants.
Right. There's a limit to two.
Yeah.
If you get three utility rooms, then you get to draw three bonus point cards. They're these orange cards that match the color of the utility rooms, and they give you bonus points for different things in your castle, a wide range of stuff that nothing else really gives you points for. So for example, they might give you points for every room above the third floor, or they might give you points for every room that is totally enclosed by other rooms. If you get three outdoors, then you get a special room called the fountain. By the way, this is where we start getting into the special rooms, which is the final room type in the game. Your throne room is a special room, and then these next three bonuses are all special rooms. So the fountain is just worth 5 points flat. The tower is what you get if you get three sleeping rooms, and the tower is worth 1 point for every room beneath it. And then the grand foyer is if you get three corridors, then you get a grand foyer, which is just worth 1 point for every room surrounding it, regardless of room type or wall hanging or what have you. Now, if you get three of a kind of the downstairs rooms, then you get to choose any other bonus and complete it. So, you know, you could choose food or utility, outdoor. If you've already chosen a bonus of any type, you can choose it again. If you haven't chosen a bonus yet, then later on you get three of a kind of the bonus you chose. You can still do it for the second time.
So like when we mentioned that you can only have at most two throne room attendants, it's literally only possible to have two at most.
Right, because you get it once by getting three rooms in your castle the living room, and then you can also get it a second time if you get three downstairs and you choose the living room bonus. Now there's another bonus for getting five of a kind, but it's the same for every room. If you get five of a kind, then you get to choose one specialty room, either the fountain, tower, or grand foyer, and place it anywhere in your house. And the last thing that you need to know about this game is that there's a couple special rules for how you can place your rooms. And those are, if you are placing a room above your throne room's level, so on the second floor and up, then it needs to have a room beneath it before you can place it there.
Right, you can't have overhangs.
Right, you can't have overhangs. But you can have underhangs when you attach a basement or a downstairs or a corridor room to your castle. They can go in columns where there's nothing above them. It's probably not going to be worth a lot of points to do so, but whatever. You do need to at least connect them to another piece. So if you don't have anything in your basement, then you have to put your first piece beneath your throne room. It has to connect to something.
Yeah.
But then anything can stretch out from there to the left and right. the last thing you need to know is that some rooms are open air. So every outdoor room is open air, and you'll know a room is open air because it has a blue border surrounding it. Then the fountain and the tower are also open air rooms. And when a room is open air, that means that you can't place things above it. It has to have a clear open area above it and to infinity.
Yeah, to infinity above it. Straight line.
Yeah. Of course, it's impossible to, you know, put any room with that's open air in the basement because the tower and the fountain have to be placed on the same level or above your throne room. The grand foyer can be placed anywhere and it's not open air. And then outdoor rooms obviously have to be placed on the same level or above.
Yeah.
So that's it. So that's the whole game, essentially.
Pretty much.
So now we can get into the strategy.
All right, yeah. So there's actually quite a bit to talk about strategy-wise. First thing is that this is a drafting game, so drafting fundamentals apply.
Mm-hmm. You can go back and listen to our drafting episode if you want to learn some of that. But the basics are that you are passing things to other players, and so you need to be aware of what they might pick and what might make it back around to you.
Of course,
but there's a bonus in this game in that you are working with the person that you are passing tiles to.
Yeah.
So there's also this aspect in this game of like you could pick something yourself, but you're about to pass it to the other player. So you might be able to convince them to pick something instead, giving you this sort of extra bonus pick.
Yeah. So this was going to be my next main point is talk to your teammates mm-hmm. and know what you're passing. Could, you know, figure out with your teammates what your strategies are going to be. Just overall work with your teammates. It's directly in your best interest.
Yeah. This is a cooperative, competitive game because you're working directly with the people to your left and to your right to build the same castle. One castle with the person to your left, one with the person to your right. So be a big team player. You know, keep them informed, hash out ideas, come up with a plan. Like, for example, when I'm planning with somebody, if I'm passing them something and I know it's in there, I'll even stack the cards in a certain order. I'll be like, this room will be very good in our castle. Or, you know, maybe if you think of something else, it's up to you.
Yeah.
But I think this room is the best. Or if they're passing to me, then they can tell me that. And then I can say, okay, now you're going to get passed a hand. I think you should look out for these types of cards in the hand you're being passed. If you see a card of this type, then pick it. If not, then pick maybe this type of card.
Yeah, exactly.
Or you could just sort of think like, we're getting close to a three of a kind here or a three of a kind there. Maybe look for that. Or maybe you could say like, we're getting a pretty tall tower. Let's keep building it up and then try to get the actual tower room for the top of it to score a lot of points.
Yeah, so as far as three of a kinds go, this is a huge part of like the strategy part, the gameplay, I guess, It is very easy, or not easy, but it's reasonable to get three of a kinds in a castle during a game. So, like, you know, in one of your castles, you'll have three of a kinds, and the other one, you'll have three of another three of a kind.
Mm-hmm.
And as far as which ones you want, you definitely want at least one of those to be utility, food, or living room.
Yeah.
Because, or basement. Because those are the ones that you can't get from five of a kind.
Right.
Right. The other special rooms you can get from five of a kind, so they're not as huge of a deal to go for from the start.
I think of those three, utility, food, and living room, because they are unique, I think the utility has the greatest potential for points.
Yeah.
The food has the least potential because the food is just giving you one room. And usually in this game, a room is worth around 4 points.
Yeah.
I think that's just a fair average, each room. In an average game where you're doing your best to put rooms next to each other so that they score points, but nothing is perfect, each room is worth about 4 points. So
yeah,
utility card is worth more than 4 points, as usual. You get your choice from three, and they're usually something like you get 2 points for every room of this type in your castle, which, you know, you might already have three of them. You might have more than that. You know, that has a potential for 6 to 8 points, maybe.
Yeah.
I think on average, a utility card will be worth around 6 to 8 points, which, mm-hmm. yeah, is two rooms, better than the food room. The living room attendant is better towards the end of the game. It might even be better than a utility room towards the end of the game. A utility room is great early on because you can build around it, but a throne room attendant, you don't usually want to build around. They're not usually giving you more points per like action spent to accommodate it.
Right, but they're very good at getting incidental points from what you already have.
Yeah, so I'd say try for the throne room. Or not the three of a kind living room, the living room attendants. If you're late in the game and you see that you have like 6 to 8 of some kind of wall hanging.
Right, exactly.
If you get it early, then you could just see what you have the most of and go for that, and then hope you get some good like corridors and other rooms with those wall hangings later on that play into your other strategies. But yeah, I'd wait late game for living, early game for utility.
Right.
And then food is only good, I would say, in two scenarios, and that's when you are close to getting a second three of a kind and you can chain them together. And the other one is if you need to get one more kind of room to make your sleeping rooms activated.
Oh, but in that regard, we should talk about sleeping rooms real quick.
Yes. As far as rooms go, sleeping rooms are
the worst.
Probably the worst.
They are the hardest to get to that max, that floor of, or that ceiling of 4 points.
Mm-hmm.
Because since they require one of every other type of room, that is 6 rooms, and you're only going to be drafting 16 rooms normally. Like, in a castle, you and your partner. So, that's like about a third of what you're drafting, just to get your sleeping rooms to be 4 points instead of one.
Right. Picture it this way. If you have a sleeping room, let's use a different room. Let's use a food room as an example. Sure. A food room has a maximum of 4 points that it can be worth. So you place a food room somewhere. Maybe you place it and it's not connected to anything. Let's assume that. Let's assume you place a food room and it's not connected to anything. It's worth 0 points. Then you place something else next to the food room. That placing that tile for that turn is worth 2 points plus whatever the tile would give you. But when it comes to a sleeping room, it's worth 1 point when you place it, which is, I guess, 1 point better than a food room. But it requires that you place 6 other tiles in your castle. And so when you take the turn later on to play one of those types of rooms, each of those rooms is only worth a half a point. Because when a sleeping room is activated, it's worth 4 points. That means you're making 3 points by fulfilling it. And it takes 6 tiles to make 3 points. So it's not worth it if you have 1 sleeping room. Now, if you have 2 sleeping rooms, then everything you place is worth 1 point, and so on and so forth when you start adding sleeping rooms. However, because you're adding sleeping rooms, that's taking away the turns that you would have probably needed to take in order to make sure you meet the requirement.
Yeah.
It's because a turn that you're playing a sleeping room is a turn that you're not meeting the requirement of the sleeping room. So, I mean, technically it's safest to play one sleeping room, meet the requirements, and then play the rest of your sleeping rooms. But if you don't get more sleeping rooms, then you can't actually make up for the fact that each room that you played earlier was only worth half a point.
Right. There's two things that I want to bring up with this. One is that every other tile has variants that allow it to make so every other tile, you can get points from getting multiples of another tile. Mm-hmm. So like utilities want multiples of whatever they're connected to. Gardens want multiples in their castle. And that means that even if you're pursuing the bonuses of other types of tiles, they're still worth points for the original one in question. Sleeping rooms do not care about the second or third of a tile, so it kind of discourages you from getting those bonuses until you have all six.
Mm.
Second, sleeping rooms are the only type of tile that can never care about themselves. So,
right.
I mean, technically corridors count because corridors that care about the same wall hanging as another corridor synergize so well that they might as well be like the utilities that care about utilities connected, or mm-hmm. the gardens that care about gardens.
Mm-hmm.
But sleeping rooms never count themselves, and so there's not really an extra payoff to getting multiples. And right. You know, I talked about like honing in on three bonuses. Really, that means you want to specialize in three types of rooms in a given castle, but living rooms make it such a big problem.
You mean sleeping rooms?
Sorry, yeah, I get them mixed up. And additionally, sleeping rooms, like the turns, they encourage you to make bad decisions because
exactly.
You might pick a tile for the castle with the sleeping rooms thinking, oh, we need this type of tile to get it turned on, when another type of tile would have been more points, or that tile could have been on your other castle.
Right. You can kind of think of it as like the effectiveness of any given room. When you're, you know, focusing on that kind of room, like when you're focusing on a utility room or a corridor, you know, the effectiveness for those rooms is with at least those rooms plus outdoor is very scalable. Like it has a ton of potential. The effectiveness for a food room is still at least 4 points. But when you have a sleeping room, it's almost like because you have to spend all this effort to acquire just at least one room of every type, those rooms that you're acquiring aren't usually effective. You have to pick them in suboptimal positions. You're not scoring as many points as you can because you just had to pick it and put it in your castle just to make sure your sleeping room was worth something.
Exactly.
Yeah, it's not good. Yeah. It's bad. And the only reason you should pick a sleeping room is if it's in your castles, like your I mean, even if it's in your throne room's requirement for points, it might even be better just to try and get to a whatever else type of room your throne room wants.
Yeah.
I think the only reason you would want to try to satisfy the requirements of a sleeping room is if you get like three of them in the very beginning of the game, or maybe not three of them, because three of them means you have to get a tower right away, and that's actually kind of bad.
Yeah.
But if you can get like two of them at the beginning of the game, and then at least one type of room that cares about sleeping rooms, so like a living room or utility that you can connect to them, maybe I would consider trying to finish that out and then getting more sleeping rooms. But
you have to be careful.
You have to be careful. It's very risky. And the payoff is very little, and usually you have to just make bad drafting decisions when you're trying to satisfy sleeping rooms. So I think just as a general rule of thumb, avoid sleeping rooms.
Yeah. So ignoring sleeping rooms, there's six types of rooms otherwise.
Yes.
And that means that there are enough for both of your castles to have three unique types of rooms that you're specialized in.
Mm-hmm.
And in this way, we kind of constructed archetypes that are good to draft into. And should we just go through those?
Sure. We can talk about the archetypes.
Okay. So the idea behind these is it is meant to synergize the three types of rooms you're picking and their bonuses.
Yes.
So first off is wall hangings. This is corridors of a single type of wall hanging, and then getting at least one throne room attendant to fit that. So that would either be basements or living rooms. Or both.
Or both. Now, this strategy is one of my favorites. Right. And I think the last two games I've played, I've won with this strategy. Or my neighbor has won with this strategy because we ended up having the highest scoring castle. This strategy has the greatest potential to score a ton of points, especially if you're lucky enough to draft a type of wall hanging that nobody else is really intending to draft.
Right. Because wall hangings are interesting because every room type has one of them, and it's pretty much the only thing that can profit from all 16 of your tiles you draft.
Yes.
Like, it can do that.
Yeah, you compare it to a living room, which wants to be surrounded by rooms of a particular type, but usually that just doesn't actually pan out to being very useful because it's like the sleeping room. You have to make sometimes suboptimal decisions in order to fill those spaces next to the living room.
It's harder to max out.
Yeah. With the corridor, at least one thing you can put around the corridor is more corridors. And those you'll always have the right type of room or the right type of wall hanging in the corridors that you're putting around your corridors. And for every corridor you put around a corridor, every non-corridor that you add to the area surrounding them is usually worth way more points, you know?
Yeah, exactly.
It just sort of scales up super well to just have a bunch of corridors with the right type of wall hanging, and then any room you get past can have that type of wall hanging. Especially good if you can find utility rooms and outdoor rooms that care about corridors.
Yeah, as well as exactly. Or basements
that care about. Or basements.
Basements that care about corridors can be pretty good.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, this is the only strategy where I think it might be okay to do sleeping rooms in a worst case scenario. Just because wall hangings are room type agnostic.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah. So that's sort of that. The next archetype I have is big multiples.
Mm-hmm.
This is either utility and or gardens, getting a lot of those that care about a lot of themselves, and then like two other types of rooms.
Mm-hmm.
So utilities that care about connected utilities, and then other utilities, gardens that care about total gardens, and then other rooms or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And then I think basements and food work pretty well in this case.
Mm-hmm.
Food because it, you know, getting another room directly relates to points this way, and it is pretty easy to chain things together in this case in terms of like getting a food bonus and then getting another bonus.
There's, I don't know if you mentioned it, but there's also utilities that care about outdoors.
Yeah, that too.
And so gardens there's a lot that of care synergies.
About utilities.
Right. So there's a lot of synergies between outdoors and utilities. They both want a lot of the same thing, which is they want another type of room, sometimes themselves, as much as you can get in your castle. So, yeah, this is very strong. Utility has one of the best bonuses for getting three of a kind. So you also have that with this strategy.
Right. This is like, if the previous one was maxing out the throne room attendants, this is made to quickly get the utility bonus card, and then you would ideally get one that cares about having multiple of one type of room.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, this is the one I've seen a lot of other success on.
Yeah. The next strategy I've found is towers.
Mm-hmm.
So this mainly wants a lot of, like, just basically a giant tower.
Yeah, so it wants a lot of one type of room that does very well to be stacked on top of itself. Usually that's food room, because food room cares about having things above and below it oftentimes.
Or utility.
Or utility, if you can chain a lot of the same type of room on top of itself or below itself for that connection bonus. It also wants a lot of downstairs.
Yeah, basements and corridors.
Especially downstairs that care about other downstairs rooms. In addition to the downstairs that care about the rooms above it, especially food and utility, like we said, those are the ones that have the potential to score the most points in this way. So the idea with this strategy is you want to get five of a kind in this strategy as best as you can before the end of the game. You don't need to get it quickly, because actually it's worse if you get it too fast. The idea is that you wait until the very end of the game to get five of a kind. And then by doing so, you can choose the tower special room. And ideally, you get about 10 points from your tower being at the top of that giant stack of rooms and basements.
Right. This is another one where I think food is really good, because even if you already have a three of a kind, food can get you that fourth room quicker or the fifth room.
Right. Yeah. Getting the three of a kind of a room, of a food room, will let you get that extra room. Or, and yeah, that can help you get closer.
If you think about it, in this case, you want to have four of a kind so that late game you can pop any of the five of a kinds that are available.
Right.
Yeah.
And yeah, basement is good here because it feeds into the points that you're going to get from the tower. And it also is, you know, a potentially useful three of a kind for the extra food room, or throwing in like an extra utility card for bonus points.
And it's that basements technically score in the same way towers do, by having a bunch of rooms in a column.
And we should mention, you know, you do get a tower from getting three sleeping rooms, but this strategy is one of the worst for sleeping rooms, because with a sleeping room, you know, you're picking these other types of rooms and you're trying to make those rooms worthwhile. And in this strategy, corridors and living rooms are worth very few points.
Right. Those will only be worth like two, maybe three.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's nice to get an outdoor room every now and then, but you don't want to focus on outdoor rooms in this scenario, because I mean, you want to spend as many turns as you can building up this giant tower before you put the final end cap on it.
Right.
Which ideally, you want to do that on your last turn.
Yeah. And then the last archetype I have is one that is a little less proven in our table, but I think it's good, which is Grand Foyers. Pretty much the idea is similar to the tower, where you're maxing out a special room. But in this case, it's making a really cramped area with maxed out grand foyers. And this would usually mean a lot of corridors and basements, and usually like utility or food or living room above, to completely encircle the grand foyers.
It definitely means having a lot of corridors, because you can only get grand foyers by getting three of a kind corridors, three of a kind basements, and then five of a kind of something.
Yeah.
I think this is a situation where obviously you don't want to do any outdoor in this case, because outdoor rooms will prevent you from building anything on top of them, which will automatically negate one or two spots that you could have filled in for your grand foyer. This type of strategy would benefit probably a lot from downstairs and living rooms. That care about maybe even utility rooms that care about special rooms.
Yeah, so there are room tiles of the seven or the six main ones that care about special rooms.
Yes.
And this is the way I think is best to maximize those, because towers and fountains are open air. And so they're a lot harder to clump together into like clusters that, you know, food and utility and living room want.
I haven't seen the strategy work yet, but I'd be interested to try it out next time I play this game.
Yeah. So pretty much in this way, each of these can easily kind of start with one or two. So like each of these cared about mainly like two types of rooms that are really good in them. And you can start with just one of those. So like early game, if you see that you just got two utility rooms, or you're getting past a lot of gardens or corridors, these are like the signals you should be looking for to go into those strategies. So, yeah.
All right. So I don't have anything else to say about the strategy in this game. I think we've covered it all pretty well.
Pretty much, yeah.
Okay, so let's get into the design of this game.
Yeah, okay. So,
So I'll let you start.
Okay. So, one big thing I've noticed playing this, drafting games can be really intimidating and unwelcoming, or uncomfortable maybe for new players.
Mm-hmm.
But, and, you know, this is because of things like having to keep in mind not only what you're picking, but what you're passing and what people are passing you. Like, there's a lot of information to juggle.
There's also a lot of information that's kept from you.
Yeah.
Like, right off the bat, you're only looking at a small portion of what's available. And, you know, you don't know what else is actually available. You have no idea what's going to be worth your time.
Right. And as far as, like, atmosphere around the table, it's really tense and quiet.
Oh, yeah, that's true.
For strategic advice if you're new could give away what you have in your hand, or other people might be reluctant to share that advice because it might give away what they have in their hand.
Mm-hmm.
There's, like, the level of deduction is uncatering to new players. But because Between Two Castles is team-based, you know, cooperative, competitive, and you want both of your castles to succeed, it is in your partner's best interests to give new players, you know, really good advice and guidance, I guess.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And because of that, it also encourages talking between hands, which helps make the atmosphere lighter, the mood less tense.
Yeah. Yeah, this game, especially if you're able to sort of intersperse the experienced players between the less experienced players, so that, you know, every given player is sitting next to another player that has a good idea of what this game is about or what these types of games are about.
Yeah.
It's very accommodating for people who aren't familiar with drafting or just aren't familiar with this game in particular, or both.
But what's neat is that it's not, like, quarterbacking isn't a huge problem, because even if somebody says, like, hey, you should pick this, you ultimately have the final decision.
Right.
So, you know, or whoever has the final decision. I mean, yeah.
Whoever is saying you should pick this has just as much information as you do. Because you can both see what's in your castle, and the person that's passing you the pieces that you are about to pick from, I mean, they've seen them and now you've seen them. So now Both of you have seen everything. The thing that both of you don't know is what the other player is getting past. And so, you know, the person who is telling you, hey, you should pick this, I mean, you could come to the same conclusion that they came to. But, I mean, there could be another factor coming soon. So maybe you could just think of something else.
Right. So
now, if you did decide on something that is dependent on, like, them also picking something, then it's a little bit less. You got a little bit less leeway, but it's not so bad.
Right. The way I kind of picture it is if there's players A, B, C, D on one side of the table, Team B, C, they always know what's going from, like, B to C or C to B, but one of them is always going to be picking for Castle B, C blind, as in, like, they just got past a hand that their partner has not seen.
Mm-hmm.
And they have to, you know, figure out what to do with that hand for that castle in that scenario. So, like, there's still aspects where you have to interpret what's best for the castle without your partner's help for that castle. So, like, there's a test.
Mm-hmm.
Which I think is cool.
In addition to this, the game, you know, you pass one direction one way, then the other direction the other way. And it shifts who has the power and the information.
Yeah.
You know, halfway through the game. So for the first half of the game, you might be telling them, like, hey, I'm passing you this, you should pick this. But then when it comes to the second round, then it's them telling you, hey, you should pick this because I'm passing you this.
Exactly.
It's much less likely that you encounter a situation like you do in some cooperative games where just one person is dominating the strategy. It's more often than not. The real thing that I guess you might have a potential to pick quarterback is, you know, what kind of strategy overall you're going to go for at the beginning of the game. But that, you know, if that's a situation, you should just try to just discuss more openly with your neighbors what you're doing.
Yeah.
Now, I will say one thing about quarterbacking in this game is that it is a strategy for victory. I guess this is one thing we didn't mention in the strategy, because we talked entirely about our own castles and what we're going to do for our own castles. But there is the element of your neighbor's neighbor's castles.
Oh, and yeah.
You don't want those to succeed. You want your own neighbor's castles to succeed that they share with you, but your neighbor's neighbor's castles need to be bad.
Yeah, I think this is part of the game I haven't figured out yet.
So, I mean, first of all, if your neighbor's neighbor's castle is similar to yours, then you can use, you know, you could just try and convince and quarterback and say like, hey, I'm passing you this piece. You need to put it in our castle because then they won't put it in the other castle. And it may have been good in both castles, but you have to try and convince them to put it into your castle.
Yeah.
Another strategy, I guess, is technically you can try in the first hand to build the castle that you're being passed pieces from the same as the neighbor's neighbor's castle on the other side of the player that you're passing pieces to. So it's kind of like you and your feeding neighbor are taking all the pieces that your neighbor's neighbors on the fed side want to pick.
I think I see what you're saying.
So that's an option. And hopefully that could maybe discourage your neighbor's neighbor's castle from going in the same direction. Like if you see that your neighbor's neighbor's castle is going for torch corridors and you see that you have one, maybe two torch corridors in your castle on your other side, then maybe you could start focusing more on those pieces and start soaking them up from your other players or from your neighbor's neighbor. And then now that could backfire in the second hand if they haven't shifted off that strategy and now they're soaking up all the pieces that you would have wanted. So hopefully you just have to discourage them in the first.
You know, you actually just made me realize the fact that you are playing cooperatively between two people means that oftentimes you kind of end up having to focus on your own two castles. Mm-hmm. And it's a lot harder to hate draft in this game. Like, just thinking about it, like, sure, you can see, like, the person two castles to your left is doing a lot of, like, corridor torches, but if you were to pick a corridor torch, then, like, I mean, that doesn't change a whole lot. It's basically wasting one tile for mm-hmm. not much help on your side, and not much of a difference on the opponent side because they get one tile still.
Well, I mean, it has to be on like the second or third pick that you do this hate draft.
Sure, yeah.
So but that the rest of that draft, you can start to get more value torches. And by getting more value, you're hurting your neighbor's neighbor's castle.
Sure, yeah. But then like the person to your left in that case, they wouldn't want to pick torches on their left. They would want to pick torches on your right where you are because you just pick torches.
What? Like, no, I'm saying like, okay, so you pass to the left.
Yeah.
In the first round. So you see that the person to your left and the person to their left are building a torch castle.
Yeah.
So you start building a torch castle with the person on your right.
Okay.
Yeah.
I see what you mean.
Yeah. So now the person on your right and you are taking all the torch cards. They're not getting passed to the person on your left so that they and the person on their left can use them in their torch castle.
Okay. Counterpoint.
Okay.
So you are only going to see, or you're drafting eight tiles, which means that unless you're in a three-player game, you're not going to see the hand you start with again. So mm-hmm. if say you're in a six-player game, then that's four of the six players that are doing that. Then the player to your right and the player to two spaces to your left are on opposite sides of the table. Mm-hmm. So their hands aren't going to overlap that much.
I mean, yeah, that's yeah. true. But I mean, the person two spaces to your left and the person directly to your left get to contribute to that castle. So
sure
there. I mean, it's, you know, if you don't have to pass it to the person two spaces to the left, it can just stop at the person to your left and they could take the good pieces for that other castle. The yeah. idea is you're just trying to make your neighbor's neighbor's castles worse than your castle.
And I'm just saying it's hard to do that to a significant amount, which I think is good for the game.
Yeah, it correct. Yeah. It's difficult. I think the only truly effective way is by, you know, is by convincing and like pleading with the person that's your neighbor to put a certain tile into your castle instead of into their neighbor's castle.
Right.
You might be building two similar castles. You might pass something. You know, there's been times in my game where when I've been playing and I've been passed a tile and it's worth in both castles, and I have to decide which castle it should go into because it can only go into one. I have to sort of figure out which one. If my neighbor, you know, had pleaded beforehand, like, I need you to put it into this castle, then I might be more inclined to do so than to put it in the other castle because it might even need it more.
Sure, yeah. Okay, yeah. That I was going to say, that is one strategy part I forgot, is picking sets of two tiles that can go in either castle. But that's a very odd scenario. Anyways, back to design.
Yep.
So, do you have anything else to say about, like, the cooperative, not quarterback-y aspect?
Not really.
Okay. I want to bring up how this game uses information and how it shows information. Mm-hmm. As in, like, on the tile. So, it uses symbols and color coding extremely well.
Mm-hmm.
Every room type has a color, like we mentioned, but it also has a symbol that represents it. So, food is, like, a goblet. Mm-hmm. You know, utility is an anvil. Living room is a fire. Sleeping room is a bed with a Z. Like, a bunch of Zs.
Yeah.
So, yeah, everything has a logo and a color, which makes it really easy to... you know, pick apart what's what. Mm-hmm. And then the wall hangings are all pretty distinct in terms of shapes.
Yeah.
You know, the torch is like a straight line. The swords are an X. Painting's a square. Mirror's a circle or oval.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So at a glance, you can easily tell all those. And then the scoring just uses boxes that are shaded different ways.
Right. So usually in a sort of array that the tile is asking you to pay attention to, the room itself will be a white box, and then the rooms that it is checking around it or beside it are black boxes. So for example, a food room that scores 2 points for each basement tile in the two spaces beneath it will show
two and a star first of all.
Yeah, it'll put a 2 and a star to show 2 points, and then it'll say it'll have a basement or a downstairs logo, and then it'll show a little graphic with a white square that has 2 black squares beneath it.
Yeah, so it's pretty comprehensive, especially with the low amount of
real estate.
Real estate. With the low amount of real estate they have on a tile.
Mm-hmm. And they could have more, but they make the image for the room very large, and the details for it, like the name of the room, the type, the color of the border for whether it's food or living or whatever, and then the description of how it earns points. They make that all very small in this game.
Right.
But I think that's okay because, you know, at the end of the game, rather than having this big wall of all these different colors with different symbols, then having to read what those symbols do and stuff, you're left with something that looks kind of like the cross section of a castle.
Yeah, I was going to say it also does a good job of making the color of the room type prominent in the artwork.
Mm-hmm.
This is something that like Magic does really well, for example, is the artwork sort of uses those colors as a motif.
Right.
Yeah. Another good part of the design I really like is the way the bonuses work.
Okay.
So, like, they're very exciting, and they're also easily attainable. You know, so, and, like, I was going to mention, like, it's easy to get one bonus in each castle pretty early on. And all the bonuses require you to reach across the table and pull something from the tray where you, like, keep all your stuff. And that's an exciting feeling to leave the boundaries that you've been working with previously and, like, get something else.
Right. Like, that's a good point. Because, like, any of these bonuses could be something else. Like, it could be, like, rearranging the tiles in your room or, you know, or swapping cards in one hand with another. Like, these are components that could be modified and messed with, but... this game just leaves that alone, and it puts out these trays for you to grab from.
Yeah, it's almost
which, by the
like,
way, are very good trays.
Oh, yeah. It's almost like opening a present. Like, I don't know, there's just this really interesting feeling, like this psychological trick when you get a bonus and you reach over to the middle of the table. Because, you know, otherwise you're completely just looking down right in front of you to the left and right. But, I don't know, it's kind of this treat.
Mm-hmm.
And the fact that you can get one of them early in the game typically means that, like, you're encouraged to get more because it is fun to do. And then that leads to, like, the proper gameplay.
Mm-hmm.
So they made, it's a case where, you know, they made the fun thing good, they made the good thing fun. Using the table space of your table, no less. Which is a rare feat for a game to do, I think. To make good use of the physical world.
I think, besides the sleeping room, all the different other kinds of rooms are relatively balanced.
Yeah.
They're all going to give you about 4 points or so. The sleeping room gives you 4 points, but like we said, it's not really 4 points. And their bonuses are all relatively unique.
Mm-hmm.
At least when it comes to the specialty types of rooms, they all score in a slightly different way. And they all want to be placed in different places. Like the fountain always wants to be placed, usually like far off to the side where you don't need anything to be above it.
Mm-hmm.
The tower wants to be placed all the way up at the top. And then the grand foyer wants to be placed dead center.
Yeah, it fits. And speaking of fitting, I do want to say this is a great game for that that narrative equity concept.
If
you've been following our Twitters, we keep tweeting pictures of our ridiculous castle designs.
Yeah,
you know, I had the food and hedonism land, which is like food and gardens, and then dungeon castle, which was just dungeons and basement and corridors and stuff.
Yeah, this game, it's really funny. When you play like a really big corridor, sometimes you just end up with one giant rectangle.
Yeah,
like one kind of symmetrical thing where it's just kind of the same shape, basement and upper floors with all these corridors that you're picking up.
Yeah.
The strategies that we mentioned, we might as well say that they're totally different shapes when you play them out
too. Yeah,
I mean, the basement tile, the basement version with corridors is a big blob. The outdoor and utility one extends very wide because the outdoors can't have anything above them, so they're better placed side by side. Mm-hmm. And then the tower one goes straight up. It's the same reason why the three room types are so interesting and good, because they go in different parts of your castle. These good strategies will make your castle form into vastly different shapes.
Yeah.
And it's very amusing to see how everyone's castles sort of lay out as the game progresses.
I do think it's also kind of neat that, like, oftentimes I'll end up realizing that just by kind of just play gameplay, me and my partner have put all the gardens in one row, almost as if it is just like a giant castle garden. Like, yeah, I just
right.
it's kind of clever. Like, it kind of plays out how you would expect.
Mm-hmm.
And it has good ways of, like, imagining what the castle would be like in this world that it exists in.
There might be a greater point here that this type of game could have just as easily been a game that takes place on, like, a tableau, like a Rosenberg game.
Yeah.
You have this, like, set grid that you're supposed to arrange your rooms in. But instead, the game just does without that and says, just like, as long as you have the supports for a room, you know, you can't put it over an empty space. You know, you could build whatever you want, which is pretty exciting and leads to these different scenarios. It kind of makes you question, like, whether certain games really need some kind of tableau to organize all of their rooms in a grid, or whether you should just be allowed to kind of expand them in any direction you want, as far as you want.
Granted, I think that because you're working with another person to make these castles, it kind of eases the problem of having, like, each player's own space.
Mm-hmm.
Like, in a lot of tableau games, it's because they don't want one player to monopolize the literal table space. But this is more communal in that regard.
Mm-hmm.
I also want to bring up something about... So, backpedaling a bit, there's a point I wanted to make with the bonuses, which is that with two castles, it's very easy for a single player to experience 6 or all 7 bonuses in a single game, just between the two castles.
Mm-hmm.
And this is something interesting to be said, is that when you play your first playthrough of a game, you want it to be representative of the rest of the game as a whole. So as a designer, you kind of kind of want to create this first play experience that is a viable reference point for the rest of the game. You know, if you were to play this with somebody at a convention, in one playthrough, will they understand the game enough to form their own opinion, see if they would like it or if they're going to buy it or any of that? And because of the fact that you can see almost every or every bonus in one game, this is an example of, like, giving that first run through completion. So, like, there's completion, which is showing everything the first time you play, or as much as possible of everything. And then there's approximation, which is like a demo reel, like showing what everything will be like, but maybe in a different quantity. And this does the former really well.
Mm-hmm. And it makes you want to play again.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
Maybe, especially, this is an interesting game where, I mean, I think one of the things that the game is super fast. It ends pretty quickly, which is a good thing for this game because it lets you get another chance to play again.
Yeah, the last couple times we played it, we played twice in a row.
Right. But, like, you finish a game and you see how everyone built their castles. Maybe you see some interesting way somebody built a castle and you think that you could do that strategy next time you play. So you play again.
One bad thing I want to bring up about this game is the usage of open air tiles.
Mm-hmm.
Every time I've played this game, I've noticed that people get open air and outdoor mixed up. And, like, they're different. They're represented differently. You know, like, the fountain and the tower have blue borders, and gardens have blue borders, but the fountain and tower aren't green colored.
Mm-hmm.
But regardless, a lot of people seem to get them mixed up. Like, they think that fountains are technically outdoor tiles or something.
I mean, fountains are a little bit deceptive because they do have some sort of, like, greenery in the background.
Right,
they
and you would like usually see a fountain in a garden anyways.
Yeah, and the outdoor tiles all look like they're part of a giant garden.
Yeah. But I think another thing is that in a single playthrough, you're pretty much guaranteed to interact with the gardens before you interact with the tower or fountain. At least, like, they appear in your hand before that. So it's very easy to mentally make the mistake of, like, compartmentalizing them as, like, you know, oh, all blue borders are outdoors, or instead of all gardens have blue borders, which means they're open air. Like, it's easy to accidentally make the wrong mental shortcut in this case. Because, it's like you compare the two, and in your head it would be like, oh, gardens are open air, blue borders are in gardens, you know. But then when you get to those towers and fountains, it's like, wait, blue borders are in gardens. Gardens are open air. Wait a minute.
And you keep calling them gardens, by the way. They're just outdoor, which is kind of deceptive.
Like, yeah, I think calling them gardens makes more sense because they're all greenery based.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think symbol is a tree.
This might be just misinterpreting what a border means.
Yeah.
Because at first the game tells you, like, a border, you know, the color that you see at the top of the tile and maybe around the edges is that is its identity. And then, but then outdoor has this extra part to its identity that it's blue. But then also the fountain and tower have this part to their identities. You know, did the whole border have to be blue even? Because, you know, if it's open air, why is the bottom border blue? Why couldn't they just make the top
or
blue?
Or, like, the usage of the border to represent placement rules isn't used in any other context. Like, I could maybe excuse it if basements had a color or corridors also had a color to show, like, you know, they can or need stuff on top of them. Or, like, you know, like, I guess what I'm trying to say is it's the only time this appears in terms of this placement rule. It's not a part of the tile that's used in any other context.
Mm-hmm.
Which kind of makes it confusing how it's used. I don't know.
Yeah, I understand. It leads to a little bit of confusion in a couple different places.
Yeah,
the usage of the blue border to notate what a open air card is.
I think honestly, this might be like the hardest thing for new players to learn, from what I've seen in like the different play groups we played this in.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Now, again, this kind of thing can be avoided if you're interspersing the experienced players with the newer players,
Yeah, and yeah, it, if you don't use terminology interchangeably.
Yeah.
Yep, but overall, I mean, yeah, like you said, this game is always makes me think about it more when I'm done.
Mm-hmm.
I think, like, the best thing, the best sign of a good game is that it makes you think about the game when you're not playing it.
Mm-hmm.
And, yeah, that's what and this game does. We've been
playing this game a lot.
Oh, yeah, we keep playing it.
Yeah.
And I still want to play it. It's great.
Yeah. Good sign of a good game. You can't stop playing it. Yeah. So I have nothing else to say about the design of this game.
I don't either.
All right. Then that concludes our episode on Castles of the Mad King Ludwig. Thank you for listening.
Thank you for listening. Between Two Castles. Yeah. Between Two Castles of Mad. They're different games. Yeah.
Yeah. Between Two Castles of the Mad King Ludwig. Thank you for listening. If you want, you can follow us, leave us a comment. Follow our podcast on any podcasting platform. You can find our episodes and our merch on our website, bgbcast.com. You can go there and that'll take you to our TeePublic storefront, bgbcast, or sorry, teepublic.com/users/bgbcast.
Yep. You can also find our Twitter and Facebook at bgbroscast.
Yep, bgbroscast on Facebook and Twitter.
Where you can follow us, tweet to us, message us on Facebook. You know, give us your thoughts, mm-hmm. your discussions. Also, in that regard, you can follow me on Twitch at twitch.tv/twack. That's twitch.tv/twak. I stream on weekdays from about 10 a.m. to 2 p.m. Central Time, give or take an hour on either end. And recently I've been playing a game called Hollow Knight that's been really fun. And then mixing in some other stuff like some fighting games and a game called Parkitect that's a theme park sim. So it's pretty fun. And if you come and watch, you can chat, hang out. There's a Discord server through that channel you can go to chat with us as well. And additionally, I have been writing articles for the BGBcast website. I currently have one right now that is about the video games I liked in 2018. And I have another one coming soon, trademark.
All right. Very cool. All right.
Yeah.
So that concludes our episode, and thank you for listening.
Thank you.